From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. More than 2 years into the COVID-19 pandemic, and new subvariants of the Omicron variant are spreading rapidly around the world and right here in the U.S. In fact, St. Luke's Health System is reporting a testing positivity rate of 14%. So, what does that mean, and will we see another surge? Joining us today to talk more about this is Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Pate, it's always good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Gemma.
And remember, if you have a question, email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. So, Dr. Pate, I know we've talked about these subvariants before, but as we begin the program today, where are we right now? Because it seems that more and more people are getting infected.
Yes. And your observation is correct, Gemma. So as a country, we're in the beginning phase of a new surge. We're not seeing that as strongly here in Idaho, but as you mentioned about St. Luke's testing positivity, we have had other signs of some increasing cases here in Idaho. Basically, our transmission rate, which we know is underreported because so many more people are doing home tests, but just based on what we know about PCR tests, our transmission rate has doubled, about doubled since the beginning of the month. And the statewide testing positivity was down in the twos. It's now at five. And your listeners may remember that our goal is for testing positivity to be less than 5%. So we're already hitting that threshold. And again, we're missing a lot of tests. So what's driving that in the United States? It's a combination of BA2, which is another Omicron sublineage, and then a kind of a sub-sublineage called BA2.12.1. And that sublineage is really making rapid increases and gaining on BA2. Wouldn't be surprised to see it replace BA2 and be the dominant one. In fact, it appears that right now they're both about neck and neck. So I imagine in another week or two, BA2.12.1 will be predominant in the United States. Interestingly, you know, I mentioned about Idaho is not, you know, although we're seeing signs of an increase, we're not having as much as a lot of other states. And so interesting, if you look at our region, which is Washington, Oregon, Idaho, of all the regions across the United States, we actually have at currently the lowest percentage caused by BA2.12.1. But it's rapidly increasing. So what may be in store for us is, if people remember what happened to Idaho back with the initial Omicron surge, which was BA1.1, we were one of the last states to have our surge. We were also one of the last ones to get over that surge. And so we may be late to the game again. And so I think we really have to be paying attention to what happens here in Idaho over the upcoming weeks to month.
And what do we need to know about these new subvariants right now, Dr. Pate? Because to my understanding, the World Health Organization has not yet named these as variants of concern, yet they seem to be able to infect almost anyone. I mean, I read something the other day that said the best defense to these new subvariants is to have been fully vaccinated, double boosted, and to have been infected before. And I was like, well, I've got all of it but the infected part, and I'm going to keep it that way.
Yes, exactly. Well, so you're right, Gemma. The European CDC has named both of these variants of concern. My guess is the World Health Organization will be following very soon. I would not be surprised if they don't designate those variants of concern within the next week or two. We'll see what happens. But certainly here in the United States, given that almost all of the current cases are caused by these two variants, we should consider them variants of concern, especially because you're right. What is different about these is that, number one, they are far more transmissible. And so we do tend to see more infections in kids, particularly while they're still in school. And of course, schools aren't masking or taking the other precautions. So we do tend to see a lot more infections with kids than we saw in previous surges when the variants of concern were not as highly transmissible or contagious. The other thing that is different about these is that up until Omicron, so Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, all of those that we've already kind of been through, those viruses, those variants of concern, they all got their advantage by being just more transmissible. What happened with BA1.1, which is what our Omicron surge was that we had back at the beginning of the year, is that that was really the first example where the big advantage to that variant was the immune escape, the ability to, not completely, but to partially get around immunity, whether you had that from the vaccine or from infection. Now what's happening that's also different is we typically did not see, if people got infected with one variant, getting infected with another variant within that same particular family, like Delta or Beta or Alpha. What we're seeing now is that the BA1.1 that we had at the beginning of this year, our Omicron surge, there's two things about it. Number one, it was not very what we call immunogenic. In other words, it didn't really stimulate big immune responses. And unfortunately, when that happens, you typically don't get very good immune protection, or at least not for very long. It was the weakest in this regard of all the previous variants we've dealt with. The second thing is that in addition to being weaker, it also provides the very least protection against other variants in the same lineage. So that means that if your whole protection is resting on the fact that you were infected with BA1 back at the beginning of this year, you should consider you practically have no protection at this point against either BA2 or BA2.12.1, which is rapidly gaining. And certainly studies are already showing that some of the variants that are in the wings that may be coming a little bit later, like BA4 and BA5, probably not going to have any protection against those. So back to your point, Gemma, what we have found is that other than getting infected, and I'm with you, I don't want anybody to get infected because we have not had the national discussion that we need to have about what the long-term effects of being infected are. So today, short of getting infected, the people that are best protected are those who have had a full primary series. So if we're talking about the Pfizer or Moderna, we're talking about you had your two shots, and then if you were in the age group where it's eligible, you got boosted, and even more protection if you're over 60 and you got a second booster.
And so then, Dr. Pate, with these new subvariants, what happens then with our immunity if we are vaccinated? I mean, are we come fall going to potentially need to be, I guess, revaccinated, especially with, as you mentioned, these variants of Omicron, what, 4 and 5?
Yes. So that's very likely. So here's what we understand at this point, and I want to just give the caveat, we do not have a complete understanding of all the immunology around this that we need to have. But here's what we understand at this point. If you have been fully vaccinated and boosted, at least got your first boost, then what we have seen is that your protection against severe disease, and when we talk about severe disease, we're talking about being hospitalized, having to be treated with oxygen, maybe having to be put on a ventilator, and or dying. Any of those things we call severe disease. If you're younger and fully gone through your full series, or if you're older and you've gone through the full series and you've got your booster, we're seeing continued very good immune protection against getting seriously ill. It appears that that protection is different than what we get from what we've all discussed about these neutralizing antibodies. The neutralizing antibodies seem to play a far greater role in the issue of what about a breakthrough infection or a reinfection. So if you've been infected and you get infected again, that's a reinfection. If you've been vaccinated and you get infected, that's a breakthrough infection. And what we see is that these neutralizing antibodies, which are only one part of a very complicated immune response, those do wane. So when people talk about waning immunity from your vaccines, they're being imprecise. That's overly broad. What we see is waning neutralizing antibodies, and they are clearly not the entire story. So what happens with the quote unquote waning immunity is you simply become more vulnerable to getting infected again. However, that group that has been fully vaccinated or fully vaccinated and booster, they still seem to be very well protected, not perfectly, but very well protected against getting severe disease.
And then just this week, Dr. Page, the FDA approved a booster, a third shot for 5 to 11-year-olds. And I am assuming this goes back to the idea of that waning immunity if you've had your children vaccinated. And I tell you, I've been trying to find a place to get my youngest boosted this week.
Yeah. So this was very good news. And you're right. This has to do with that concept of waning immunity. And we saw that play out prominently in kids in this age. They tend to get that waning immunity, quote unquote, which I want to clarify, that's overly broad statement, because the 5 to 11-year-olds do still, it appears, have significant protection against severe disease, but they are becoming at higher risk for getting reinfected and or having the quote unquote breakthrough infection. And it seems to be related to the fact that we are dealing with Omicron sublineages, which already have inherently more immune escape capability, plus the fact that these Omicron variants are far more contagious, transmissible, and we've relaxed our protections in school. We have kids in large numbers physically present for many hours a day in schools. So all of these things are kind of putting those 5 to 11-year-olds at greater risk. And again, I want to just emphasize, I'm not saying that your greatest risk calculation should be whether they get severe disease or get hospitalized or die, because that's very low, and especially if they've gotten the primary series. What I'm talking about is their risk for getting reinfected and then the risk for long-term health implications from that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pate, before we get to questions, I want to talk about something with these new subvariants, and that's testing. Very long story short, my youngest was complaining of a sore throat late last week. So ended up taking him to urgent care because he tested negative with COVID at home. I thought maybe he had strep, go to urgent care. and they run a PCR test on him, and also then tell me, keep testing him all weekend, because these new subvariants are showing up in the throat. And he also said, we cannot use a swab and test in the throat. We have to go in the nose, but it's going to show up quicker in the throat than in the nose. And in fact, what this doctor told me is that it's taking upwards of 4 to 5 days to test positive if you're testing the nose. Thankfully, my kiddo was fine. But what are your thoughts on this, Dr. Pate? Because I had not heard that before.
Yeah, well, I applaud your physician because that physician gave you very good information. So what we see with and we've seen this with most all the Omicron variants, is that there may be a little bit more of a delay before a rapid test, one of these tests that you do at home, or mm-hmm. some doctors have them in their offices too. But the rapid test, there may be a delay of a number of days until that test turns positive. And so, Jim, this is incredibly important information. I'm so glad you brought this up, because if your child or your spouse or whoever it is that you're dealing with has symptoms but is testing negative early, do not take a negative test as conclusory that person does not have COVID, because it may just be too early. And so your doctor was exactly right that we suggest that you do serial testing. And in fact, probably even with these Omicron ones, if you get symptoms, just go ahead and assume you have COVID, stay home, isolate, and then wait for a couple days to begin doing your rapid tests at home, if that's how you're going to be testing, because they often are negative really early, only become positive day 3, 4, 5, as your doctor was saying.
Mm-hmm. So then, Dr. Pate, let's talk about a question we got in from Dolores in the Magic Valley, because she wants to know why it's so difficult to obtain a prescription for Pavlovix. She got a positive PCR test. She's 78. She's immunocompromised. But she says she got the runaround over the weekend trying to find a doctor to give her Paxlovid. But then she did find out that you can only get it at certain pharmacies. So she wants to know why this isn't easier. In particular, Dr. Pate, if it's taking longer to test positive for this, you might potentially be out of that window where Paxlovid would work effectively, correct?
Well, you've got it exactly right, Gemma. So for Paxlovid to be effective, ideally, we like people to start it within 3 days of the onset of their symptoms, and definitely within 5. And so you're right, this is a challenge. So, what I would recommend is, if you get sick, again, you might, unless you're really ill, of course, get in touch with your doctor right away. But if you're just having, cold, flu symptoms, and you're at home, stay home, wait a couple of days, test, because you've got really the ideal point to start the Paxlovid is 3 days after the onset of your symptoms. Test on that morning of day 3, see if you're positive. And that's enough to qualify you for Paxlovid, by the way. You don't have to have the PCR test. The alternative is, if you are particularly at high risk, maybe that second day, go in to the doctor and get the PCR, because that might take about a day to get the result back. And then that puts you on day 3. Ideally, what we find works best, we just don't have many options for this, is so-called test and treat centers, where you can get the test, you wait there. If it's positive, they go ahead and give you the Paxlovid. To answer your listener's question, why is this so difficult? The reason is that Paxlovid is distributed by the government. So the only way you can get Paxlovid is for the government to purchase it, and then the federal government distributes it to various pharmacies and so forth. And so that's why it's only in certain locations The other obstacle, I think your listener said that when she tried to contact her doctor, it was the weekend. And we all know that's a problem with the American healthcare system, you know, is it seems like everybody gets sick Friday night, but then, right. you know, the weekends you can't get your doctor usually. So, or is a different doctor on call. So this can be a challenge. And of course, in those situations, you may want to consider going to an urgent care. So one, you know, and that's the other thing to do in your planning. If that day three is going to be Saturday, well, don't wait for that and get in touch with your doctor before the end of the week. The other thing that's difficult about Paxlovid is, first of all, it's under emergency use authorization, and the FDA's emergency use authorization says it's only for high risk people. So somebody who's 20, 30, good health, gets COVID, unfortunately, you're not going to be able to get Paxlovid, most likely. Now, your listener clearly sounds like she would be in the high risk category. The other challenge is it's very complicated to go through potential medication interactions with or from Paxlovid. And so a lot of these people are at a higher risk or at high risk because they have a lot of other medical problems. Generally, when you have a lot of other medical problems, you're on a lot of other medicines, and then that can be a challenge trying to determine if it's okay to give the person Paxlovid with all those medicines. Some doctors are more comfortable with this than others, but all of these factors are playing a role.
And then Dr. Pate, Jake wrote in, he said, if a 70-year-old is planning a trip to Europe this summer, should he delay getting his second booster until 2 weeks before departure?
You know, it's a good question, and obviously that listener's thinking very critically about it. You know, what I would say, first of all, you know, as I, and I've said this before, you need to think carefully if you're doing international travel. And the reason is a lot of other countries make sudden changes in their COVID requirements much faster than the United States does. So you could be in another country and things be perfectly fine. They have a big surge. All of a sudden they do some kind of a lockdown or make it much more difficult for you to travel. And all. You just need to take that into consideration. We've also had, depending on which country you're going to, some of those countries, people didn't even know it. They were traveling to those countries only to be met by the military and buses where they just take you to a hotel to quarantine until they know you're okay and at your expense. So you just really need to do your homework, check very carefully about that country where you're going to, what their rules are, how they're handling this. You also need to consider what their disease activity is, because we've often seen new variants present in other countries before they do in the United States. And so one big concern for right now is probably within days, BA5 will now be predominant in Portugal, the first country that to, outside of Africa for it to be. So I don't know if this person's going to Portugal, but you know, that would be a consideration because we think you have the least protection from prior infection or vaccination against BA5. So I would consider that. As far as timing for a second booster, I think, yes, there's the consideration of your travel. And if everything was good in the United States, I might say, yeah, you know, maybe that makes a lot of sense to wait and get it closer to the time you're traveling. The problem is, it's like timing the stock market, and it's very hard to get this right. And right now, we're seeing a surge here in the United States. And so I actually would be a little bit concerned for him to put off the second booster as we're getting ready to have this big surge, at least in parts of the country, from BA2.12.1. So I would say, you know, I would probably go ahead and get the second booster. That's what I did. And then, you know, we'll deal with things as it gets closer to his trip about what other additional precautions he may want to take.
Dr. Pate, Ingrid wrote in, and she says, can you ask Dr. Pate about nosebleeds as a COVID infection sign? My sister has been vaccinated 3 times and has had COVID, but now she's feeling like she has COVID again, and she's been having nosebleeds 3 to 4 times a day over the last 4 days. She tested positive at home, but because of the nosebleed, she's not sure if it was accurate or contaminated. So they're just wondering if we know anything about this.
You know, this is not a common problem, but of course, anytime your nose becomes irritated, and we do see that with Omicron a lot due to nasal congestion or runny nose, sometimes people will get irritation to the lining of the nose and will have bleeding. I don't think that would have likely altered her test result, but I can't say for sure. And probably, you know, we do know that there are some things about COVID that can affect the ability of your, you know, blood clotting and that kind of stuff. It might be, because this is unusual enough, it might be worthwhile seeing you know, her physician or an ear, nose, and throat doctor just to have a look and make sure that there's not something else causing the bleeding, because bleeding from the nose is pretty common and there are some things that we can do about it. And perhaps even getting the PCR test just to confirm.
Susan wrote in and she says, I'm 67, healthy. I've gotten 2 Pfizer vaccines and a booster. I am not aware of having COVID at any point. I was on the verge of getting my second booster several weeks ago when I got the results from a blood donation, which indicated that I have very high antibodies. Is there any way to know how long these might protect me? And I'm trying to hold off on the next booster with the hope that it gets fine-tuned for new sublineages.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, there's not. The antibody test that is done through blood donation is a very generic test. In other words, it doesn't tell us which kinds of antibodies, the amounts of those antibodies, how protective those antibodies are. And we frankly have seen very little correlation because generally at this point, and I think we will get more refined in the future, but at this point, we typically look at neutralizing antibodies as the surrogate for what's going to convey immunity. And with people that have those antibody tests, we really can't tell, well, how many of those are neutralizing antibodies, how many of them are binding antibodies, how strong are the neutralizing antibodies. So there's just no good way for us to be able to make any kind of decision about whether those antibodies are protecting her or how much they're protecting her. And so I would not use that in her decision making. Basically, if she's over 60, if it's been 5 months since her or more since her first booster, I would sure go ahead and get the second booster now. Don't try to time this. I don't think anything about what's being contemplated for this fall for the next booster series is going to be contraindicated because of getting a booster now. It's probably going to build on it. And of the various types of vaccines that we're thinking about for this fall, which will be different, they should all be fine if she goes ahead and gets a second booster now.
Dr. Payne, Alex writes in and he says, could you please tell us what you know about the increase of other viruses in the population? It seems like I'm getting colds a lot more often now. My family's getting sick more often. Is this because folks are not wearing masks anymore?
That's probably the major reason. So that is, you know, he's made a great observation. If you look back to the cold and the respiratory virus season is typically the fall and winter. If you look back to 2020, even 2021, we had very low levels. And that was because people were still taking this seriously. People were masking. There was a fair amount of masking in schools. But many respiratory viruses are actually facilitated by kids being in school. That's clearly the case for influenza. That's the major way it mm-hmm. distributes through our population is kids get infected at school, then bring it home, infect families and relatives and friends and so forth. So, yes, I think it's relaxing all of our precautions in schools and too many schools still not having high quality ventilation and filtration systems so that now more kids are getting infected. And then they, those little precious kids bring those viruses home to us and we see more viral infections.
Dr. Pate, you brought this up briefly earlier in the program, but we have a question from Dave, and I think it might be good to go a little bit in depth in this. And he says, so Dave says, what is the relationship between transmissibility and the strength of the infection? It has been said that highly transmissible viruses provide a typically less dangerous infection and vice versa. So true or false? And this is what you mentioned about Omicron, the first Omicron variant when we had that surge in the winter.
Yeah, I would say that's in general a false statement. So, so transmissibility has to do with the behavior, the characteristics of the virus, and the behaviors of humans. And so, if you have a virus that is circulating, to which much of the population does not already have immunity. And I would tell you, I've heard people referring to the amount of immunity we have in the United States. Let me tell you, every sign I see that is way overstating our degree of immunity. And we can talk about that another time. But when you have a virus that the factors that are going to contribute to transmissibility is how inherently contagious is that virus? How does that virus spread? What is the characteristics of the population in terms of degree of immune protection? And then what is that population doing that would put them at risk for however it's transmitted? So with coronavirus, we're talking about a virus that is transmitted predominantly through aerosols, so through air streams. So that means that the activities that are going to make that most transmissible are larger groups indoors for longer amounts of time with poor ventilation. And that's our general situation. So these viruses are inherently highly transmissible. What's happened is with all of our successive variants, that degree of transmissibility has increased, and in other words, the contagiousness has increased, and we are now seeing with Omicron much more tricks up the virus's sleeve, so to speak, about how to get around our immune systems. So that's transmissibility. Now, severity of illness is very different. And where I would say his correlation between the two, where it does have some merit, is with many viruses, how severely you get ill is related to what we call the viral dose. How much virus do you take in? And so if you have a virus that's very transmissible and you're getting a lot of it, then yes, that often tends to correlate with more severe disease. Not for all viruses, not in all cases, but there is a correlation there. However, that's not the primary driver. And with COVID, as certainly we have seen, even though we've gotten much more transmissible viruses, it hasn't always resulted in more severe disease. And part of this is complicated because we changed the immunity factor. More people have gotten vaccinated and protected. But if you look at the impact of those more transmissible viruses on people who are unvaccinated, in fact, we do see that they still get very severe disease. Mm.
Well, Dr. Pate, as always, we so appreciate your time each week. We've been talking with Dr. David Pate. He is the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of that coronavirus task force. Dr. Pate, thanks so much.
Thanks, Gemma.
And we will be back with a look at the 50th anniversary of the Sawtooth National Recreation Area.